Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Ancient Office Hours by the Ozymandias Project. Trireme Transit is now boarding for all new and returning passengers. Now departing, present ponderings. Next stop is Ancient Office Hours at a library lost in the sands of time.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 68 of Ancient Office Hours. My guest this week is Dr. Jennifer Stager, a professor of art history at Johns Hopkins University. Her areas of research include theories of color, materiality, feminisms, multilingualism, ancient Greek medicine, and classical receptions. She is the author of Seeing Color in Classical Art and co-authored Public Feminism in Times of Crisis, From Sappho's Fragments to Viral Hashtags. In this episode, we discussed her becoming an art historian rather than following in her archaeologist father's footsteps, her work with colorful ancient art, how the color book led her to write a book on ancient medicine, and how video games handle recreating colorful statuary. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. You can also subscribe to our Patreon, as this will also allow us to reach more people and make more exciting ancient world content. Enjoy. Thank you so much for joining me this evening. So I just want to, you know, get the ball rolling and ask you, how did you get into classics and ancient history?
Oh, great. Yes. Thank you so much for that question, because I have been thinking about that particularly today and yesterday. Because I don't know if you can see it on the Zoom blur, but this is the only physical copy of my new book that I have personally held. And the reason I have it is that my high school Latin teacher sent it to me overnight by mail. Yeah. Because he is based in the UK and the book is only physically available in the UK right now. It was printed by Cambridge and they do this sort of timed rollout. So it was published in the UK in mid-December and it won't reach the US. I don't know exactly. I guess it's all printed in the UK, but the physical copies will not reach the US until March. And so my high school Latin teacher, Dr. Andres Reyes, who is now retired from high school Latin teaching and is continuing to work on archaeology and is based at Oxford, he went into Blackwell's and bought a copy of my book and mailed it to me, which was just so incredibly generous. And he was like, I really thought it was important that you have a physical copy. And it's true. It was like really meaningful, both to hold the book and look at it and, you know, just see what its physical material reality was. And also just that he sent it to me. I'm really grateful. So that is the sort of long-winded and very current reflection. But like the main thing was I went to a high school that still required people to take Latin, which was a very kind of like old school requirement. And I was really, really lucky in the teachers who I had there. Many of them remain active or remained, you know, for the duration of their lives, active as archaeologists, as, you know, scholars of antiquity, publishing, digging in the field. And during the year, they were teaching Latin at a high school in rural Massachusetts. So what to say about that? Well, so it was both a requirement and you could keep going. And the people who kept going, as I'm sure other students of classics have experienced, you know, the classes get a little smaller. You have so much more proximity to different professors. And, you know, you were talking about this experience of going to office hours and then talking to your peers and finding that they didn't go to office hours. I think one of the real benefits of the size of a lot of ancient language classes, especially Greek and Latin, is that they're small enough that you have so much direct contact with the professor. And that just normalizes talking with professors, being in community with professors, having conversations with them. And it makes something like going to office hours feel really comfortable. Whereas if you're in a much larger class or you just haven't had a lot of interaction with your professors, it doesn't necessarily seem like a safe or straightforward or comfortable choice. And so I think that may be one reason that people don't go. But so, for example, my Aeneid class was only two students. A friend of mine who now works in the National Gallery in London and who was incredibly helpful to me in procuring some amazing images of their Artemisia Gentileschi exhibit that was just under her first name, Artemisia, that actually opened and closed during the pandemic. And so it was not really seen in person by, I think, anyone. If it was in person, it was a very short run. Most of it they had to do virtually, and I didn't get to go to London for it. But Caroline Costin was the only other student in the Aeneid with me. So it was the two of us and one professor. And that was incredible just to have that kind of focus and attention. And I also had a professor who recently passed away, Hugh Sackett, who was an archaeologist digging at Palaestro in Greece, who was a Latin teacher and also did additional kind of electives in archaeology. And so I, as a sophomore, enrolled in his archaeology class, which was basically like a cool kid's senior class with him. And then me, it was very awkward. And he told me that I was too young to go on the spring break trip. So I didn't get to go because everyone else was much older than I was. But it was my first experience of looking at the material culture of ancient Greece. And I actually did get to travel with him and his wife at a different time, not with the older seniors, but but during the summer, and visit a lot of archaeological sites with them up coastal Turkey, which was amazing. And so these were the kind of teachers, and I think you do find these kinds of teachers a lot of times in ancient languages who went really beyond the classroom and with whom the relationships kind of endure for so long. So obviously I stayed in the field, which is among the reasons, but I know these teachers to be engaged with students who went on to do totally different things as well, but just like keeping up with them, wanting to know how they're doing, et cetera. So that was my first experience. And I think there's been a lot of really interesting and important attention on, recognizing the importance and value of teaching languages at an earlier age, so like middle school and high school, and really validating the importance of those teaching roles. There's like a second piece of the answer, because I don't want to be disingenuous, which is that my father was an archaeologist working in the Middle East. And so I also grew up around archaeology and material culture. He didn't study Greek and Latin. And in fact, he was from a farming background in Ohio and had grown up with like biblical texts, which is how he had come into archaeology, like sort of through biblical history. And I think there's a way in which for him, because those weren't languages that were taught in his school system, you know, he was really like interested in the fact that this was something that I got to study. You know, it was like a point of difference between our educational experiences, but also one that he like really was interested in and valued. And so I did get to work like most of my childhood in on an archaeological excavation in Ashkelon, Israel. And so I got to see a lot of Middle Eastern material culture, some of which is also imported from the Mediterranean, and think about those contacts in a really hands-on way. Although I was like studying languages that were, from the Mediterranean. So it was kind of an interesting contrast.
Hey, that's pretty cool. I don't know many people whose parents are archaeologists. So obviously, I mean, having a father in archaeology would lead you to know and see more about the field than a normal person would get access to. So, I mean, with that, you know, did that influence you directly? So were you like, okay, he's an archaeologist, so I kind of want to go into archaeology? Or was there a time where you were like, oh, well, maybe I could be a philologist, I suppose, you know, maybe I can do something else? Or was it always just like, no, I like the art?
That's a great question. I mean, I definitely identify as an art historian. My PhD is in art history. I teach in an art history department, although I have a lot of wonderful relationships with classics and archaeology. And I think that sort of like very granular difference in some ways is very specific because my dad did not, see himself as an art historian and necessarily, I think sometimes the types of questions that are being asked of the same material can be a little different in terms of, you know, maybe like fitting a historical moment into a much broader and kind of horizontal chronology, like thinking about how visual material shapes culture over time and how those objects like recur over time is something maybe more art historical, whereas archaeologically, I think tends to be more of a focus on, kind of analyzing the data around a particular historical moment. I should also say, like, there was a really interesting volume that I got to be a part of that was edited by Chris Watts and Carl Knappett. And Carl Knappett is a Bronze Age archaeologist. Chris Watts is working in the ancient Americas. And they were really interested in that comparison exactly, but like, what is really the difference between art history and archaeology? How are the methodologies different? And how are people approaching kind of similar material with different kinds of questions? It's called Ancient Art Revisited. It's both looking at, you know, what do the ancient Americas and ancient Mediterranean have to say to each other, but also like, what do art historians and archaeologists have to say to each other? I was always really interested in the ancient world, and I just had this weird mix of, you know, hands-on experiences in one region and then languages connected to primarily a different region. And sort of figuring out how to bring that together was something that I had to think about a little bit. And then I did work outside of, you know, before I went to get my PhD in a totally different industry, which, you know, my parents were like, what are you doing? But it was a good experience to step outside of academia for a little while before coming back.
I mean, you raised some good points because that's the question of, you know, what's art history and what's archaeology. I think not enough people question that, but it was funny. At Mizzou, we had the art history and archaeology department. And so when it was time to pick up a minor, I picked up a minor in art history and archaeology. I asked that fundamental question. And I think I asked a professor of mine, I was like, well, you're in the department, but you focus on, she focused on like votive figures at Corinth, right? And I was like, okay, so you're clearly sort of doing Greek art and you're digging some kind of like, where's the art history part? Is it the history of the votive figure itself? Or is it like the material? And she was like, oh my gosh, why did you have to ask me this? I don't know what I'm doing. So it brings up a lot of really interesting questions because it's a continuous question that I feel like people sort of come upon and they go, oh, that hurt me. That hurts my brain. I don't want to think about it again. I mean, I just asked like an art historian the other day and they were like, I don't know. And I've got a friend who's doing an archaeology program here in Athens. And, you know, he's talking excitedly about how he's getting all this art history stuff. And then he started complaining because he was like, yeah, but a lot of our requirements and our things are tied up with art history. And I was like, so what's the problem? Should they not be together? Like, they often are. Like, it's weird if they're separate. And that, you know, opened this whole can of worms of like, well, a lot of times they're together, but should they be separate? And if they should be separate, why are they separate? Or if they shouldn't be separate, why did they need to be together? And I was like, oh my gosh. So I it's like fascinating. And I was like, I love art history.
I totally agree. And I think, you know, on the one hand, like I'm not anyone to get deeply invested in like policing disciplinary boundaries because those are relatively modern and, you know, hugely artificial. And at the same time, like, There are different disciplinary histories, even if they're all kind of coming of age in a similar kind of late 18th, early 19th century moment. And like the history of ancient Mediterranean antiquity also is still in this very liminal place in terms of where it gets taught. So my understanding is that most programs in Europe do not teach Greco-Roman or Mediterranean antiquity within an art history program. There may be one or two, but in general, that happens within a classics faculty. In the US, sometimes, like where I trained at Berkeley, there was a robust ancient Mediterranean program of long standing within art history. You could also study Mediterranean antiquity within the classical archaeology program in classics or through a non-disciplinary or kind of extra-disciplinary program, AHMA, ancient history and Mediterranean archaeology, which was more focused around area studies and making sure you had, you know, the historical knowledge, the languages, the archaeology, and the art history for the particular area that you were going to focus on, and maybe with a particular emphasis on cross-cultural or intercultural connections and exchange. So there were like three different ways on the same campus, and we all interacted with each other and often had the same professors, but also were, you know, doing our work within distinct disciplines with their own kind of methodologies and their own, in some ways, disciplinary histories. So it's very liminal. And then, you know, the question of whether an art history program is going to have someone teaching, you know, ancient Mesopotamian art or ancient Greek art or ancient Roman art or, you know, ancient Mediterranean, or another region of antiquity or not, is an open one. Not every art history program has it, some do. And then, of course, there are material culture people who are housed in a classics department where the majority of their colleagues are teaching language. And that's a different, in some ways, experience. So like my department, History of Art, one of my colleagues teaches Mesopotamian art, and we, you know, tend to partner in advising students and sometimes have collaborated in teaching classes. But we have colleagues in other departments who are also teaching ancient material culture. And then, of course, we have colleagues in our department who teach later periods of art history around the world.
Yeah. I mean, I think if it had been a little better defined, or even if there were just more people at Mizzou, I would have loved to actually pick up a double major. I think it would have been fun to be a double major in art history, archaeology, and classics, but just the nature of the way things went, that didn't happen. I am curious, though, so since you did have an archaeologist father and you did have interests of your own, but you were also influenced by that, how did you make the decision to specialize in what you specialize? Because I feel like, you know, there's a lot of options out there, and it's not easy to narrow those down.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, I would just kind of come back to where we started, of that having, you know, because of the language classes, having these really small classes, getting a chance to interact with teachers really closely in high school, and then that kind of carrying into college. So I had a really wonderful mentor, Irene Winter, who teaches she's retired now, Mesopotamian or Western Asian art. And I did a lot of work with her in art history, but I was a double major in art history and classics. And so I did a lot of Greek literature, and that was almost like adjacent. They weren't totally integrated pathways. They were like not totally separate, but they weren't always or overlapping. And so when I graduated, I went to the UK for a year, and I did a 1-year master's in classical archaeology, which was mainly a coursework master's doing like Anatolian archaeology. And I think the contrast between that and having done a lot of art history with Irene and with other professors as an undergraduate, helped me to realize that I wanted to do my PhD in an art history department specifically. And then once that was kind of in my mind, you know, those were the applications that I submitted. And it was in some ways, you know, limited to the places where there was somebody teaching ancient Mediterranean art within an art history department. And there aren't that many still in the country. I mean, there are a number of really great programs, but it's just not always represented in every history of art department.
Yeah, no, and I'm curious, because I think I read somewhere that you have focused on sort of color and when it comes to statuary and stuff. So did you have any notion or idea that, you know, that would become a very highly controversial and debated topic? Because I feel like a lot of people, when they hear this, that it's a topic, you know, of contention, they're like, I don't understand this. Like, why should it be? It's just a statue. And of course, they couldn't just be this like pasty white color. But when you were getting into it, you know, were you like, oh yeah, this is going to become big and huge? Or were you like, it's just interesting and I didn't expect it to become like a big thing?
No, I mean, I will say, like, when I started the project, which was in the early 2000s, it was weird. Like, it wasn't something that people were like, oh yeah, of course you're doing that. And I had to do a little bit of, you know, justification to my committee. And thankfully, you know, my PhD advisor, Andrew Stewart, who recently passed away during an extraordinary career, you know, he was extremely supportive of our independent ideas. You know, he didn't try to redirect us and kind of let us, you know, choose our own topics and direction. And so he, I think, you know, thought it was a little odd, but he was not opposed to me pursuing this topic, which was, you know, kind of about a phenomenon rather than a corpus of material. How I came upon it, though, was really because I had had this early experience of taking the archaeology class with the Bronze Age archaeologist, who was also a Latin teacher with the seniors, et cetera. You know, he taught with black and white slides, like the projected slides, which, you know, pre-PowerPoint. And in that era, almost all the books were printed with black and white images. It was just, you know, there wasn't the financial capacity to print books with color images, and those, a lot of objects hadn't been photographed in color, and especially objects from the ancient Mediterranean, because there was a kind of presupposition that that wasn't the important part, right? The important part was the shape, the form, the kind of stylistic change over time, all of which could be readily accounted for in black and white photography or drawings of objects. They go together, like the idea that a line drawing of an object or the photo, black and white photograph of an object, can convey all that you need to know. And of course, those are important, really valuable tools, and also important for dissemination of images and their circulation to a much wider population and access. However, they edit out often a very important part, which is the color. And so I had only seen black and white slides. On the one hand, you know, I was working on an excavation in Israel, but we were working on earlier material, so like 1000 BCE and earlier for the most part. And then when I was looking at, you know, 6th century and later material in the classroom, it was in a black and white slide, you know, context. And also we used Gisela Richter's Handbook of Greek Sculpture as a textbook. I later learned, and the current show at the Met, the Chroma show at the Met, does a wonderful job of capturing this, that Gisela Richter, who was a curator at the Met for a long time, was very interested in color and did her own research on color, even in the 20s through the 40s, while based at the Met. However, her Handbook of Greek Sculpture is published entirely in black and white images, as was the norm. So I just hadn't seen the color until I was in a graduate seminar at Berkeley, and one of the slides of the Alexander sarcophagus, which is a sarcophagus that was excavated by Osman Handi Bey from Sidon and now in the Istanbul Museum. And it has a lot of pigment still on the outside because it was found in a burial context, which tends to preserve colors a bit more. And so my advisor, Andrew Stewart, put up a slide of a close-up, a detail of the Alexander sarcophagus. And I see this eye, and it was painted, and it looked like the eye of a painting, not what I was used to seeing in these images. And it was like an epiphany. I mean, I know it sounds a little corny, but it's like, wow, how did I never see that before? And I think lots of people have a story of their like first kind of encounter with color on ancient Mediterranean art. And it does feel like a, wait, how did I not see this before? Because once you see it, then you see it everywhere. And so it was really this like disjunction between the black and white slides and the black and white photographs in textbooks, and this moment of kind of encountering a color slide, it was still a slide, but, you know, a color photograph, and how different that looked. And that was, that moment was contemporary with the first Gods in Color show that was put on by the German team in Munich in 2004. So that show, that's when the show opened, and it was their first round, and they've subsequently done, you know, many different iterations, but their first round of color reconstructions on sculpture. So I got to go see those within 6 months of having this, you know, in the classroom encounter. So it was a combination of like what I saw in the classroom and then getting to see the exhibit and really think about like, what would it mean to take on color as a topic? And it turns out it would mean like a lot of time and research as it turns out. But I don't think in that first moment I had a sense of, you know, the scope of the question. It was more like, wow, wait, I didn't see this before. And then when you go back and look at, you know, my Andy Stewart's 1993 book, Greek Sculpture and Exploration, it's also black and white photographs, because that was even the 90s, you know, that was really typical. But he refers to color throughout. It's just many textbooks did that. Many handbooks did that. Many specialized articles would refer to the colors. But when you don't see them, it doesn't register in the same way. And so you can go back to 19th century articles, and they often will talk about a lot of different color traces that were visible on objects that were found in the 19th century. But that doesn't mean that we've like incorporated those notes basically into our like broader story of the of the Art of Antiquity?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure I remember. I mean, I think for the most part, we did have color images by the time I got to college. I mean, we had, you know, the nice technology. I was in college, 2013, fall of 2013 through 2018 or something. So we had all the technology, but you know what? It's true. Cause I think we had one professor who happened to be my favorite. I loved her so much, but she was very old school. She was on the older side. And so people just loved her, but she refused or was afraid of the technology. So she would insist on using her old slides. And so she'd be the only professor in the entire department or probably the university who would insist on coming with her box of slides and would use the projector. And so she would use these slides that she'd been using to teach for the last, you know, 20 years, whatever. And a lot of them were black and white. And so I think it's very stark because then it was like, I was going the other way, right? So I was seeing all these images of these things in color, and then I see them black and white. And I remember I would sit in that class and think to myself, man, these are like, these dull them out. You can't see, you don't get an idea of just how colorful. And I think it would have really, really changed my idea or perception about them. And so, yeah, I can only imagine going the other way.
No, I love that you are going in the opposite direction. And it's true that digital photography has allowed the circulation of, you know, high quality color images in a way that just really technologically wasn't an option before. And people, you know, hand added colors to prints. They, you know, would include some color images in the part of the book. But like, I was very lucky for this, my recent color book, that the whole program is in color. And that was something the press, you know, made a point of doing because the book is about color, but also it's only possible because of digital photography and printing costs. And you still have to deal with the, you know, kind of spectrum of what's available in the actual moment of print. Because I can see some disjunction between the physical book and the digital version. It looks a little bit different because the colors have to be printed onto paper and they naturally, like, you know, they appear different on that substrate. So yeah, but that's really neat. And wow, she held on to the slides for a long time because Berkeley we were committed to slides for as long as we felt we could be. And that was a much earlier transition, but Kodak stopped supporting the technology. So, you know, a transition necessitated by technological change.
I mean, I think also Mizzou, just like we had some like old historic buildings which had the thing with the screen you pull down so that it was able to better accommodate. But yeah, it was just interesting because she was like the only one to really use it. And I mean, she retired, I want to say like a year or two after I graduated. So that would have been 2019, 2020. But it was very striking, because I would always sort of ask her about it and stuff like that. And, yeah, she would say, you know, I've tried the new stuff, but then because of her age, she would always say, well, I can look at screens, but not for too long, cause then I get dry eye. And so she just said, you know what? I kind of like how it's a blast from the past for students that it's like high school memories that, you know, I bring the old school stuff out. And so I just said, look, you're wonderful, never change, because this is like very different. And this is, we're not going to get this very much later. But yeah, she was using her slides until, I want to say 2017, 2018. I mean, it was impressive. It was super impressive.
Well, so it's just really interesting because like a lot of times if you talk to students now, like no one's ever encountered a slide. So now you have had this, you know, this interesting experience of like, you know, really being immersed in digital images and also then having a kind of throwback experience of looking at objects through slides and kind of seeing that contrast. So it's pretty
amazing. Yeah. And I definitely get to, like, you know, now I get the benefit of, I can sort of relate to my older colleagues who this would have been like their experience. So like when they didn't start out with all the newest technology and they saw stuff that was older, I'm like, oh, okay, I understand that. But then now also I can look at my younger colleagues or people my, you know, age and grade and be like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. We had all the technology, we had this and the other thing. So it's kind of fun being able to like relate to and see both worlds It's interesting. So I'm curious about your research a little bit. How did you go about making the decision to specialize in the way that you have? Because I feel like what you're doing is so interdisciplinary. I feel like I see a lot of people who kind of have to pick, right? Whether they're like forced into a decision of, no, I only want to specialize in philology and only do this, or I only want to do the material culture part. But in kind of reading your background, your bio, I'm like, oh, this is like jumping off the page is super interdisciplinary. So, you know, was that deliberate?
Yeah, so that's a great question. No, I don't think it was deliberate. It's the first thing. I mean, one, I definitely primarily identify as an art historian, and that's what my PhD is in. But coming in, that unfolded over a time, you know, sort of to get to that decision. So as an undergrad, I did classics and art history, and I almost did them like really separately. Like I did art history, and at that time I was working closely with Irene Winter and really thinking about ancient Near Eastern, Mesopotamian, Western Asian art with her. And then I was doing classics as a sort of second degree, again, kind of as a separate track. The classes didn't necessarily intersect. The departments where I was didn't really have a huge amount of overlap. But I also worked in the art museum. So those kind of, all those three things were happening. Like my student job was in the art museum. I was double majoring, but they were kind of separately tracked. And then I did a master's in classical archaeology, which was, you know, very focused on kind of excavation reports and material culture from an archaeological perspective. Then I worked for a couple of years, and then I went back to grad school in art history. And so it was kind of a path of like testing out these different disciplines in small increments and then kind of committing to art history, because at Berkeley at the time, which is where I did my PhD, there were multiple ways, and there remain multiple ways to study the ancient world. So there was a classical archaeology track within classics, obviously all of the philology friends in classics as well. And then there is ancient history and Mediterranean archaeology, which has a couple of analogous programs across the country, but is a kind of combination of philology, archaeology, history, and art history. And then there was art history itself. So I do, I think, align with the interest within art history of, you know, one, a kind of prioritization of the visual material, though not in isolation from the text, but I'm also super interested in the materiality of text, the idea of texts themselves as something that can be studied as objects as much as sort of content. But also the way that art history's focus is not necessarily, we all have sort of subfield expertise, which one could call an area study, but there is a burden to, you know, be communicating across subfields and to be deploying methodologies that are legible to people who work on a totally different region or time, or both region and time period, but across the board are kind of prioritizing the visual material. So that was sort of a long answer, but it was a kind of deliberate decision to find a disciplinary home. But because I came to it through these other disciplines, I think that has allowed me to have a kind of, you know, a framework for stepping outside of the discipline as well.
That's awesome. I mean, I feel like it's a good basis to start really adding more to it, which is why I'm curious, because I saw also that you do have a book about ancient medicine, and that's like, that's pretty different from art history. So like, where did that interest come from? Like, were you always kind of like, I really like medicine, so let me just figure out a way to study it?
No, that's a great question. So it actually comes out of the color book, weirdly, but one of the arguments in the color book is that color as a phenomenon is largely approached as a material phenomenon. So thought about as something that imbues in its materials, which is not, I think, a concept that is so unusual for art practitioners, even in contemporary moment, but is not how theoreticians of color have historically talked about color in modernity, where we think about it as something that's dematerialized and that doesn't have a kind of direct attachment to earth or stone, but is something that's kind of perceived. Whereas I think a kind of pre-Newtonian or pre-modern understanding of color across a range of cultures and over a long period of time, is to think about color as something that inheres in materials. So the tie-in between the first project and the second project is actually that at the level of material, there are a lot of stones, earths, pigments that are both used by artists as colors and used by healers as remedies. And a lot of that is tracked in for example, Pliny's Natural History or Theophrastus's earlier natural history work in Greek. So in the color book, I looked at on stones carefully in a chapter that's about mosaic and assemblage as a kind of paradigm for art making. And on stones is about stones across the wider Mediterranean, but it's also about pigments. It's also about glass. So for Theophrastus, there isn't this extremely rigid distinction for what makes something a stone. It's something earthborne, at least in part. I mean, glass is also manipulated with fire. And is a kind of technically an arrested liquid. But Theophrastus groups all of those together. And he also mentions when there is a kind of known to him healing remedy that a type of material can be used for. That's something that Pliny does at much, much greater length in Latin in a later period. But he's definitely drawing on Theophrastus, among others, for his compendium. So there was this like little bridge between the color work and the medicine work, which is a weird bridge and was only visible because of this deep interest in materials. But so then when I started thinking, okay, well, if artists and healers are sharing materials, like what other things are they sharing? So the part of the project that I'm working on right now is about tool use and artists' use of tools and their craft of tools, because they're also tool makers, as something that contributes to early medical practice, that it's a kind of shaping mechanism for healing practices. So I'm very interested in, like, I guess, the role of the visual arts in something like producing or making medicine.
I mean, that's so cool because that's a connection I definitely would have made, wouldn't have made, because, you know, I had a great conversation with another scholar who studies ancient medicine as well, but definitely more on the like theoretical side and sort of the medicine and the body. And I just kept thinking the whole time you're talking, I was like, oh, you know what would make a really great mashup? I would love to hear more about the combination, right, of the sort of materiality of the medicine combined with her more theoretical perspective, because I think that would be something super interesting to hear about.
I think I was working on this project before the pandemic, but like everything, you know, the pandemic reshaped some of my approach to that project, as it has reshaped, you know, everyone's approach to everything and priorities, et cetera. I also had kind of in my personal experience a fair number of medical, you know, experiences, often as a caregiver, but through my mother, my husband, one of my children, all had kind of significant medical interventions that I was a part of. So even though that was happening in the very contemporary, I'm sure it was partly guiding my move towards the second project. Sort of think about like, how did we get to where medicine is today? What are some presumptions that are built into modern medicine that maybe don't, you know, how is that history different from how we receive it? I mean, there is a kind of very, very simplistically, there is a genealogy for modern doctors back to Hippocrates. Hippocrates is given his own kind of genealogy as a child of Asclepius. And that's a very patrilineal history, which is a crafted history, right? And I don't think people would dispute that craftedness, but like, what if you move beyond that craftedness and sort of think about the alternative stories that are there in the record? And then do those tell us something different, I guess, about how medicine unfolds from this, you know, kind of inherited textual tradition?
Yeah, no, definitely worth looking into more. I do really want to ask, since it came from the color book, though, I'm really excited to ask you about the color book, because I think if anyone has paid attention to classics in recent years, they know there's always these ongoing arguments about the color of the Greek statues and all that. You know, they're not originally white the way we see them sort of now. And yes, they were super colored, and it might look weird if you're not used to seeing that. So yeah, tell us a little bit about your color book, because I feel like more people will want to read it if they know kind of a little background on it.
Okay, great. Yes, I hope they will. So this color book came out of my dissertation. And you're right that these questions and these kind of reactions to what we think we know versus what, you know, the kind of abundance of traces of color in the art historical and visual record and the conservation record show us, like that tension is just repeated over and over again. And one super interesting question, I guess, is like, why do we have to keep learning this? Like, we keep relearning this. There are always these moments of surprise and confrontation and friction with what we thought we knew and what we come to see through exhibition, through, again, conservation science, which I think has been really fundamental to really closing the case for an if was there, wasn't there, and instead actually getting us to a point where, like, there was color everywhere. And actually, that's not surprising. So why did we live with and work from a narrative in which color was not present? I would also say that that question tends to create the most controversy, surprise, debate, specifically when it comes up for sculpture, and specifically marble sculpture. So that, and that is one of the media and kind of materials that are in the book. I don't ignore sculpture, but what I tried to do was to think across materials and media, to sort of think about color as something that is widespread, ubiquitous, and a part of art making, whatever medium you're pursuing. And in fact, because color sort of traverses these different media, it also might invite us to think differently about the barriers between media that we, and this is really an art historical position, you know, have worked from. So that often in the past, one would work on sculpture or one would work on painting, but one might not work on sculpture and painting together, even though sculptors and painters did work together. That's how we get polychrome sculptures. Right, is a sculptor or sculptors carving in collaboration with painters painting, like adding what I am sort of calling an additive color to the surface of the sculpture. So that was one of the interests, was the, sort of what adding color back does to, you know, how we've thought about art making in the past. For the ancient Mediterranean, which has so often been, it's a strange kind of position within art history as both very foundational, but also not the central kind of height of art making, right? It's a sort of stepping stone too. If you look at like art historical surveys, a lot of ancient art, which in the US is often studied within an art history department, but in other countries is often studied, you know, art history more commonly starts with the early Middle Ages or late antique, kind of post-Christianity, quite frankly. And so this sort of question of where ancient art belongs, does it belong in a classics department? Does it belong in an art history department? And how, if you're studying ancient Mediterranean art from inside an art history department, you know, one, obviously you're not, you don't fail to be in conversation with your colleagues in classics and in archaeology, but how is that maybe a different place to be studying this material than if you were situated in a different department where the demands on your time might be different as well? So those are questions that were present for me. Also, the timing was very specific. So I started my PhD in August of 2003. And I, along with your previous guest, Nandini Pandey, was very lucky to be participating in this interdisciplinary center called the Townsend Center at Berkeley, which gave us summer funding to pursue interdisciplinary research. For three different summers, it was three. And we also kind of came together over the course of the year. So you were in community with PhD students who were in different departments, and you had some support to do different projects over the summer that were related to, you know, interdisciplinarity. And that first summer, the summer of 2004, was the opening of the German color reconstruction show, Bunte Götter, or Gods in Color, which now has traveled, you know, all over the world. I don't know how many iterations, but certainly it's been in Istanbul, in Athens, in Copenhagen, in New York most recently. So San Francisco in 2016. It was briefly in LA in 2008. It was part of a show that wasn't explicitly their reconstructions. It was called Like Life. No, sorry, Like Life was at the Breuer. That was a show in New York, but it was called Roberta Panzanelli curated it. I can't remember the title of the show from 2008 at the Getty, but just to say that this set of reconstructions of Greek and Roman, primarily marble sculpture that they're reconstructing on plaster replicas using historical pigments, has had a huge impact on the field in terms of allowing the wider public to visualize this material, and also on scholars, giving them a kind of foothold for responding to or integrating their research. And I think it has been vital. And they're very clear that they're coming out of a long tradition of their PhD advisor, Volkmann von Kreva, and scholars before him. And certainly there were widespread debates in the 19th century. So there is like a long tradition of working on this. At the same time, for me as a graduate student, where I was, you know, had this same experience of surprise, at Encountering Color in an early seminar, and then got to go to Munich to see this first iteration of the show, and was honestly shocked at how popular it was. There were like lines out the door to go to the show, and that wasn't something you saw regularly with ancient Mediterranean art in museums at the time. This was at the Glyptothek in Munich. So it made a big impression. And also I was interested in why this was material that I hadn't seen, which isn't to say it wasn't there, but I hadn't seen it in the material culture that I was studying. I hadn't thought about it. And so I wanted to know why I hadn't thought about it up to that point.
Yeah, no, I think it is shocking. I mean, obviously there's a difference between like the like more contemporary art and then ancient Greek art with color. But it was funny because I remember my first reaction when I first learned about these statues actually being quite colorful. I had just finished either seeing or reading. No, I think I went to see. It was a Keith Haring exhibition. And it was so colorful. And I keep thinking to myself, wow, what if the Greek statues were like this and these bright colors that he used? I mean, they weren't quite. It was a very different vibe. But that's the kind of shock that I would describe, right? Seeing where you walk in and you're like, what is this?
I think people have had that. They keep feeling that shock over and over, and are interested in or provoked by that feeling, which again, to me, felt like something worth analyzing and studying. And it kept being interesting, right, for a very long time. To be able to sustain your interest over the course of writing a dissertation, research and writing a dissertation, and then transforming that dissertation into a book, like, it has to be a pretty cool topic.
Right. I'm curious. Okay, so since you would describe yourself as an art historian, which awesome. I got a minor in art history. So I'm like, well, I can't really claim to be one, but it's fun to sort of still have the skills. When you watch like movies and TV shows or anything that depicts the ancient world, does it bother you that like half of the ancient things, I mean, and it depends on what civilization, of course, you're watching. It happens more with Egypt, I would say, not so much like Rome. Sometimes Greece, it'll go either way. But does it bother you when it's like, for whatever reason, they don't choose a time period where like art is its most beautiful at its height. And so then you just see like random falling apart, crumbling monuments that are like half destroyed. Does it like grate on you? And you're like, no.
I mean, no, but only because I don't have like, I don't have a deep like aesthetic attachment to this period. I'm interested in it intellectually. And sometimes I find the work incredible. And sometimes I find it really not. And that to me seems fine. So I don't, but I do think the movie approach or the video game approach, like some of it is like the fantasy or the kind of romanticism of the ruin is something that gets kind of perpetuated by films, where that is sort of what people want to see. They want to see a little crumble. They don't want a perfect restoration. I think that's also something that people have chafed against in these color reconstructions, is it feels uncomfortable to them to have the whole body finished or whatever, not just be a fragment, because we have so romanticized the fragment or the ruin. And lots of artists have done that subsequent to, you know, the historical moment that's being reconstructed. No, but I also think that increasingly, and you've done a lot of work on video games in the ancient world, so you would, I think, have more insight into this than I, but like, I am really interested in how much work, and I'm most familiar with Ubisoft and the Assassin's Creed series, not as a player, just as a spectator, but, you know, how much work they've done to recover color. And yes, I think you're right, preserve a certain ruin aspect, like what you're climbing is not the whole building. But they also have really added back a lot of elements that you can't see in person. But you know, you can climb the rooftop and see the frieze set up in the temple. And that's a very cool feature. I'm very impressed with that. The one I'm thinking of, so I have a section in the book that's on, in the color book, that's on bronze statues. Because I think, you know, we have an increasing number of bronze statues from the ancient Mediterranean to look to. It's still very few relative to their widespread presence in antiquity. And so that's one of the issues that comes up in color reconstruction, is we're so often working from a later marble iteration of a bronze statue anyway, which exists, you know, is also produced by an artist, is its own artwork, but is a different artwork than the bronze that it may be citing or working from. Those bronzes often had inlaid eyes, have an area in a book where I'm really interested in kind of philosophies of vision and the production of inlaid eyes, which are like these little micro mosaics of eye parts, mm-hmm. and sort of how art practice might contribute to philosophical thinking about vision and seeing and being seen, which you can only get to when you recover the inlaid eyes of bronze statues. So you have to have the bronze and you have to think about those vacant holes. That is what we most often encounter if we have a bronze head in the first place, as having been filled with these fitted together materials that make up an inlaid eye. So all of that being said, in Assassin's Creed Odyssey, when you get to Delphi and you see the charioteer, whose inlaid eyes are still physically intact. Like if you go to Delphi as a, you know, not in the game, but in real life, you see the statue and it has its inlaid eyes still in the bronze. A rare example of both eyes being intact, etc. Strangely, even though they have done a wonderful job of adding color back to Delphi as a sanctuary, they have made the eyes completely monochrome. They're a kind of gold bronze, which is the whole statue is. They've done a great job of giving us the brightness of the bronze rather than its patina over time, but they got rid of the inlaid eyes. And I find that so strange because the inlaid eyes are actually there. So I don't know. I mean, I would be curious to talk to the developers, like why that detail. Was it too weird to see the inlaid eyes? People definitely describe an experience of that being creepy to have the eyes like looking back at you. But of course, that's part of it, right? Like ancient people probably found it creepy too. And that was why the statues had them. They wanted the creepy.
I mean, I suspect it's such a small detail that like they just didn't, like most things, right? It comes down to probably a budget, money, time thing. But, you know, yeah, so I have a lot of problems with a lot of the temples are basically cut and paste. They're not the original friezes and like the pediments are all wrong. But it is funny because some of the deliberate choices, like when you're running around the agora, I noticed that they perfectly reconstructed based on the body of research we have. The Stoa Poikile. It's like, it's literally the way that it is described in all of our, yeah, I was like, because I walked past and I was like, is that, that looks like the Stoa Poikile? And then I was like, no, that can't be.
Right. So that makes me think that they're in a way that their sources are more off, like maybe a little more text-based, right? Because
maybe. I mean, I know they often make experimental choices in things like these games. You see the same kind of pattern in Assassin's Creed Origins for ancient Egypt. They went with the Jean-Pierre Houdin theory for the pyramids, which I was like, oh, you went with that one? Okay, fine. Interesting. So yeah, I don't really know what goes into the decisions. I mean, I know they have a historian, but still, I'm like, does she make the decision? Do
you? That's a great question. And like, you know, like that points to something within the space of making the game that I think is applicable more broadly for our making is super interesting to me in general, is this idea of like, you know, we often talk about one artist or one expert or one author, but the truth is there are a lot of people who are making us decisions that lead to something being made. So the game is not, you know, yes, they're consulting people. Yes, they're, but as you point out, there are budget constraints, there are design constraints, there are time constraints. All of that is also impacting what the final product is like. And I think that's true of ancient art workshops too. You know, we're talking about like, where can you source the stone? What can you afford? Who is available to transport it to where you need to work on it? Who's available to work on it once it's transported? You know, what skill set do they bring to the piece? And then, you know, what happens after it's made and for whom?
I mean, it makes for nice little surprises for classes, for historians, I suppose, because I guess it leaves you guessing. Oh, I wonder what they're going to get right. I wonder what we're going to see that I don't like. And then you see like the random thing that you're like, I love this. This is such a small detail. And then you see the big thing and you're like, but you missed the big thing. So it's very funny.
I mean, like at Delphi, I love how they've set up so many objects. Like it's a populated space. You get this sense of how teeming with objects the sanctuary is from the game. So like, and I mean, to that, in that sense, it's a success, right? Like just like a reconstruction exhibit, just like other people's digital reconstructions, they're a success because they produce a response, right? We think about what we're seeing in different ways. And I guess the only complication to that sense of, you know, all of these possibilities being successes because they make you think is that they can also you know, become the new narrative. And where film, I think, has played a role in that, and I've just heard this feedback from students, it's like who they cast, right? So who gets cast in roles, which, as we know, is also a subject of public debate. But, you know, because, and this is the person who I've heard, you know, students refer to on multiple occasions, but like, because Russell Crowe plays Gladiator, there's this assumption that, you know, that Romans, one, look like gladiators. You know, that's one example of what a Roman looks like, et cetera. But also that they might be kind of quasi Australian. And then, you know, so like there's, you know, not that people are not able to see that it's an actor playing a role, but that there is a kind of slippage where because he plays this iconic role in what is now a kind of old film, but a film that a lot of people have seen, that becomes a default for what a Roman man might have looked like. And in fact, we know from research like Professor Pondy's and many others, like that there is such a wide diversity of how people looked in the Roman Empire and in earlier periods in antiquity. And so that, I mean, obviously that puts a lot of pressure on the filmmakers to be more creative than they have historically been in terms of how they cast things, but also just to acknowledge that it has a real impact on what people allow themselves to see. And that in this moment, people are much more likely to see a film or play a video game than they are to read my color book. Or not even necessarily unfortunately, but just like acknowledging the power that these creative spaces have in terms of how people think about history is important. And podcasts have a huge power too. Like people listening to podcasts all the time and in, you know, increasing numbers. And so recognizing that that is also a pathway to, you know, to inviting people to think about history in the past as it shapes our present.
That's true. That's true. I want to keep talking about the media stuff, but I know that you and I will be here until we're 100 years old because there's so much to cover. So I will try to make it snappy and ask you just one last fun question, I suppose, before we have to move on. But out of all the different media adaptations out there that you've seen, do you have a favorite, like, monument or like statue or something recreated that you think has been done really well?
Okay, I'm going to punt on it slightly and not commit to a specific reconstruction, but just to say that I think the work that Monument Lab is doing right now to really think about the idea of monuments as such and like what makes a monument, what should make a monument, how to think about monuments in history, that is, I think, really vital work. And the question of whether, you know, what historical monuments should be preserved, what time periods of a particular historical monument, if it's ongoing, should be the focus of attention. I think those are very interesting questions that, again, kind of Monument Lab, which is focused on our current landscape of monuments, is also inviting us to think about historical, deeply historical monuments. And, you know, and also not to pursue a kind of utopian vision of monument making is always political. It's always about preserving one narrative, often at the expense of other narratives. And so ancient people did that too, right? Like some of their constructed narratives are produced in and through their public monuments. And part of our job is not just to preserve and amplify those, but to critique what they chose and what the legacy of those choices have been. And the space where I see those conversations as particularly active is the Acropolis and, you know, what historical moments of the Acropolis should be reconstructed. You know, how do you decenter the 5th century, given the long, long history of the site, while also recognizing that the Parthenon is kind of the building that most people are coming there to see, you know, and that it was built in some ways with that in mind. And related to that, I would say, where I close in the color book with the Nashville Parthenon and thinking about the way that a site from antiquity gets transposed into other places. And Danny Ortiz, who did her postbac at UCLA and who's now at Hopkins working with me, she has done some work on a monument in Athens that has been replicated all over the place, including in Scotland in the 19th century and in the United States. Lysicrates Monument. Thank you. Sorry, it was just at the edge of my mind. I think, you know, some of her work in tracing out the iterations of this monument is also really intriguing. Like, why does this form that has a very specific meaning in one historical moment go on to be integrated into, public civic building facades, into religious facades in vastly, vastly different territories. And sort of similarly, why does Nashville end up with a replica of the Parthenon? That's roughly to scale. And what does it mean that they did, that they chose to invest that kind of energy and capital into producing one in the late 19th century?
There are kind of three hopefully easy questions that I kind of asked to end the interview portion of the podcast. The first one was, when you were a student, did you attend office hours?
I did. You know, I guess I would just encourage everyone to. I know that part of the backstory of the podcast is that you, as a student, attended office hours and found that you were in the minority. And it's true. I think that students, one, their time is extremely booked out, but also that there's, it's meant to be an open space, but sometimes it doesn't seem inviting, or it's only if you need paperwork signed, et cetera. But the reality is, professors are human beings, and face-to-face human contact, or Zoom-to-Zoom face-to-face, however we're constructing it, is a really vital part of these engagements. And also, the humanity of what we do, right? Teaching, researching, all of it is about, at least to some extent, humanities engagement, even if you're working on, beyond the human or the non-human in the past, it's often still related to ideas about humanity more broadly, but also just recognizing that what we're doing as people in the world, and it doesn't really exist in isolation. So coming to office hours is a great way to humanize professors, also to recognize that as humans, they're very fallible. I don't know that there's as much a mystique around the job anymore, but in the past, I think that office hours sometimes didn't seem as inviting. The door is meant to be open, right? It's meant to be open to build a connection and to learn beyond the kind of more scripted space of the classroom. I really, really, really benefited from work with professors as an undergraduate. I was super lucky, even though I said in the beginning, that my art history track and my classics track were kind of separate. They were, but I had very strong mentors in both. And so I worked very closely with Irene Winter, who took me to New York for the first time in my life, really as a field trip. But, that was a lot of, there was just one other student with us, and it was just two of us and her. And I remember she very explicitly told me, pay $1 when you go to the Met. It's a suggested fee. You're a college student. And I wouldn't have felt permission to do that, I would have felt like I had to pay whatever their posted ticket price at the time was. Now I know that their ticketing has shifted a little, but at that time, everyone was, it was a voluntary fee. Now I think if you have to live in New York for it to be free, but there was something really empowering about that advice, which has nothing specifically to do with Western Asian art in antiquity, but is a great, sort of tool of permission. And because of her, relative authority and mentorship, I could hear that advice from her and I could give them $1 and walk through the gate and feel kind of empowered in that moment. So that was really important. And then she was on leave my senior year when I worked on my thesis, and I worked very closely with Albert Henricks, who, may he rest in peace, who has since died, who was a Greek professor. So really working on the language side with him. I was working on an object with imagery, but it had inscriptions in Greek and Phoenician as well. And he was wonderful. I mean, he really made incredible amounts of extra time. It's actually, now when I think about it, it's almost inconceivable how much time he was willing to devote to, working through the epigraphy with me and all the laborious German scholarship that had, looked at this funerary monument in the past. I don't know, both of those relationships, which were separate relationships, there wasn't a lot of overlap between the two of them as mentors, but they both really did serve as mentors. They were vital to me feeling, a sense of active participation in the field.
Yeah, everyone should go. I'm so happy that answer kind of also answered the other two questions. So no, I was like, that was actually the most succinct way you could have done it. So it's perfect. So at the end of each podcast, I have all of my guests read Shelley's Ozymandias poem. And if you could read it and then just give us your thoughts on what this poem means to you and why you think people find this poem so intriguing all these years later.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive. Stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." I hadn't thought about this poem in connection with another poem, which is now currently escaping me, but that is about a kind of fragmentary statue. But this idea of something that's designed to endure, and in a sense has, right? Or you wouldn't be able to produce this ekphrastic description of the pedestal and the words and the fragments of the sculpture. Obviously, it is to your point about, you know, the ways that movies and video games and other media have captured the ruin. It's also, as a poem, focused on the shattered visage, the way that the object no longer presents as the kind of commanding whole that it was designed to be, that it isn't the same monument that it was designed to be. I guess, you know, the thing that it's bringing to mind for me right now is that any monument is always going to be approached by a different person in a different moment, even if it's only 3 seconds apart, as a unique encounter, right? And so here we have a kind of ekphrastic description of one encounter that emphasizes the pastness of the monument, the pastness of this kingship. You know, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. And yet, are we despairing looking on this poetic description of the sort of surviving but diminished, I don't know if diminished is the right word, but you know, sort of less monumental, right? This is not the description of an imposing monument. This is just a description of a monument that is no longer dominating the landscape. And so his inscription, in a way, you know, comes to us from a place of postness, that we are after this moment where one might look on him in despair, and instead we might look on this this poem and think about, you know, the evolution of time, the relentlessness of time, and in a way, the fragility of even the very monumental of objects of the past. So those are things that come to mind for me, but I am not a poetry scholar and I would invite other guests who are more skilled in the art of poetry for their commentary.
But this is so perfect. This is why I don't, well, this is why I ask anyone who comes on the podcast, but also this is why I don't make a point of asking just poetry scholars, because I love the perspectives that come. And actually, it's funny because I've now read this poem so many times. I mean, I can recite it in my sleep. It's been my favorite poem since I was like 12. But until just now, I hadn't really sat and thought about the poem itself as necrosis. And this is why I love talking to art historians, because I'm talking to mostly classicists who do philology and they don't describe it. And, you know, they get all the other meanings and messages out of it. But wow, it's necrosis. That I knew I liked this poem.
I work with a lot of poetry, but as an art historian and kind of seeing what poets are able to pull out of the language, I'm always incredibly impressed with what poetry scholars and poets themselves can see or hear in a text. I guess, yeah, the part that I can see and hear is the ekphrasis.
that's good, because I learned something new from every person who reads it, even though, you know, one will eventually think, oh, well, can I really learn that much new? Because I've read this thing or I've heard it read to me so many times. There's always something new. So it's quite exciting. So that's my lesson for today. I've kept it. It's an ekphrasis. But when I normally read this poem, I read it for, and one of the things that sticks out to me is that it's a memento mori, right? It's a reminder we will die. And it's really about the ephemeral nature, not of just political power, but of all power. Ramesses II thought he was going to have his civilization be the way it was when he was pharaoh for eternity, let's say. Well, look at it now, kind of. So, you know, considering that it isn't, you know, the power of legacy and the power of all these things that go into it, and monumental architecture, but also just monumentality as a legacy. You know, thinking about what happened to him, and then if we consider our contemporary society today, right now, do we have a modern Ozymandias, something that we think is kind of gonna be around forever, stand the test of time, but like, honestly, if humans, let's say 500 years from now, you know, are they going to think this the same thing? Or are they going to look back at us and be like, you know, oh, that was a bit crazy?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great question to leave the audience with, maybe, Lexi, because I would venture that at this moment we've seen enough Ozymandiases or enough ruins to know at some logical level that nothing endures. And yet it's very, very hard in the immediate moment to believe that. And at some much more, widespread level, that's like where we seem, as a broader society, very stuck with respect to climate change. Like, is it possible for us broadly, planetarily, not to endure? Well, surely it's possible. We have a lot of scientific evidence that it's inevitable. And yet that's not how we move through the world on a day-to-day basis, or most of us. And it's such a struggle to figure out, you know, how to get to collective action to try to slow down or reverse that process. And so I think some of that is that, like, yes, we recognize that the monumental will not endure forever, because we have seen over and over again how fleeting such, you know, purported endurance is. In the moment that we make a monument, we have to briefly kind of imagine that it will endure. I mean, I think that's, that tension is always present.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, it's a hard question, but I do. That's why I leave it for the end, because it's a great question. I hope that we'll just get people thinking. And I hope that the audience always comes up with cool new things to think about it. But the very last thing I do want to ask is, where can people find you? If they want to look, you know, find your research, your musings, your work, anything, or even your email to you know, email you about maybe coming to take a class with you.
Yes. Oh, thank you. That's a great question. So my email is jstager1@jh.edu. That's my work email. And it should be also on the Hopkins website. And there's a link to some parts of my research on the Hopkins History of Art faculty website, but I also have my own website, which is jenniferstager.com. where I have tried to capture a variety of different projects and to sometimes speaking engagements. I tend to post about those after they've happened rather than before, which is not that useful, but I'm, you know, open to hearing from people and would love to be in contact with your audience. So either email the Hopkins History of Art website, which is my work presence, or jenniferstaker.com, which kind of captures the range of different projects that I've been involved in more recently.
Great. Well, we will make sure to link any or all of that in the show notes so people can go and we'll make you findable. We're all about accessibility here. So I just wanted to thank you once again, you know, for coming on and doing the podcast, because it's been such a pleasure. And I always love talking to art historians.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Lexi. I really appreciate the invitation. I look forward to talking to you more about podcasting in general. Thanks again.
Trireme Transit is now departing ancient office hours. Next stop is Present Ponderings.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.